This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With eight delicious flavors, you are guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice and games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another product. With amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first Element order, Element will give us 100% commission. Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you'll be instantly refunded.
Our next partner has a product I use every day. I started taking Athletic Greens because I wanted a simple all-in-one solution as opposed to the ever-changing variety of supplements I have been taking for as long as I can remember. Sometimes up to 3 ramekins a day full of pills and powders trying to find the right formula for peak performance. Now that I've been taking Athletic Greens for a few months, I love it, and I will never go back. With one delicious scoop of Athletic Greens, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. I take one scoop in the morning on an empty stomach, and an additional one in the evening when I am feeling run down. I have seen such a difference in my own performance that I recently ordered additional AG1 for the rest of my family to use. It costs you less than $3 a day, you're investing in your health, and it's cheaper than your cold brew habit, and supports better sleep quality and recovery, in addition to mental clarity and alertness. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/contacts. Again, this is athleticgreens.com/contacts to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
Welcome to the Contacts Coaching Podcast, dedicated to bringing you practical ideas from coaches, sharing what they have learned throughout their career. The show is designed to serve as a digital database of mentorship from a wide network of coaches whose innovative, reflective, and diverse knowledge may offer ideas to enhance your experience. In addition to sport-specific expertise, each episode also dives into the ways in which culture, strategy, and tactics can cross from one discipline to another. I'm your host, Justin Klein.
Welcome back to the Contacts Coaching Podcast. We are blessed to be joined today by Mark DeLuca, currently head badminton coach at Valley Christian High School, former basketball coach. Thanks for being on today, coach.
And remember, former football coach too.
Former football coach as well. We will get into that on the story time here.
Right on.
All right. Yep. So let's dive in here. And if you could help us ground the audience in your background, how did you get into coaching? How did you get your first job? What did that look like? And then what was the process and or chronology of you bouncing through your career and the different hats you have worn?
Yeah. So it was strange. I went to St. Pat's High School in Vallejo. I was wild and crazy, and a guy took me under his wing. That was Don Lippe, was the basketball coach, and I was his TA every year from sophomore through senior year. So I knew at the age of 16 I wanted to be a high school basketball coach. And then, because I wanted to be like him, he made a huge impact on all the kids, and it was like, man, that seems like a great life. And ironically, I just spoke at his retirement. He retired this summer, and I was one of the featured speakers. So that was full circle. That was cool. Went up to UC Davis to play football. Go Aggs. And just love that experience with Jim Soaker, Bob Foster. Bob Biggs was my receiver coach. I just had luck having Lippy, then going to Soaker, Biggs, and Foster. Total random luck. I was trying to make a move to L.A. I had 1 foot in L.A., 1 foot in the East Bay. And I was playing basketball at the rec hall, where I'm sure you played a lot of basketball games. And this guy I kept meeting. I didn't even get his name. We just kept meeting to play hoop. He asked me what I wanted to do. I go, hey, I want to be a basketball coach. He's all, come down with me to L.A. My dad's a coach. I'm like, okay. Back then, not married, not doing much. You're a young kid. You can just fly with the wind. I went down to L.A. with him. And it turned out he didn't tell me this, but his dad was Paul Westhead. It was Paco, Petey Jr., and just had an opportunity to be around that whole incredible scene a little bit with Hank Gathersburg, him on all those guys. Got to basically watch those practices and just really blessed, watch those practices. And then afterwards, the LA Lakers would come practice with Pat Riley. I literally did basketball 6 hours, 8 hours a day, just watching and learning. And one little kind of a shout out, if anybody's watching those Laker Dynasty shows or anything like that, the caricature of Paul Westhead is nothing like. They did a horrible job acting like he doesn't know what he was doing and fumbling with his words and all this. The real truth is Pat Riley stole Paul Westhead's act. That's the truth. It was Pat Riley who was the country bumpkin from Kentucky. Westhead was the slick guy in all this. Riley learned from Westhead. That's my opinion. And I don't know how much you want to get into this or not, but the whole thing about the offense was too slow. That's why Magic didn't. It was because Westhead wanted Magic to play defense. And those were the days when the coach could get on the superstar rookie. Now you can't. Remember what happened with, who was it, Nelson and Chris Webber or whoever that situation was. Westhead was saying, like, hey, man, you got a guard in this league. And Magic was a little upset at that. Now, as it turned out, it was a great move by the Lakers to get Riley. And Magic is, in my opinion, the second best basketball player in the world, not named Larry Bird. And then I have Jordan as three and Kobe. But Magic's incredible. But a lot of that show, in my opinion, as a person who was physically down there, got to see a little bit more than the average bear. No, I'm not down with that show, how it's painted.
Fair enough, fair enough. After that, where did you end up?
And then from there, I just opened up the old CIF coaches book. I don't know if you remember those little books at every school and all the head coaches. And I said, I want to go to LA. I wanted to coach at Venice High School. I applied for that job. Didn't get it. I didn't deserve it. I was young and I didn't have enough credentials. And I got interviews at St. Elizabeth High School and at St. Ignatius High School. My interview at St. Elizabeth didn't really go well. They asked me, what book do I recommend the kids read before they graduate from high school? I think I said The Stan Musial Story or something. That wasn't really the answer they wanted to hear, but they hired me anyway because I could do football and basketball. The day after I agreed to do that, St. Ignatius called and wanted to know if I wanted a job. Leo LaRocca, who's an awesome guy. Chris LaRocca, his son, was one of my teachers in high school. SI offered me a job to be an assistant football coach, but I gave my word to St. Elizabeth, and I went there. And from St. Elizabeth, I bounced all around, primarily to Pinole Valley High School, which I still love dearly to this day. From there, I went to De Anza High School in Richmond, stayed in the East Bay, Oakland and Richmond area. And then a dream job of mine that I always wanted was Berkeley High. I think I applied for that job 3 times and got rejected 2 of those times. And then finally, they hired me and we had a nice little run there. State championship versus one of those LA teams. I forget even who we played, but that was a nice gig. And then after that state championship game, it was Jolene. I fired off an email to, I saw in NorCal Preps that Valley Christian was looking for a basketball coach. I emailed Jolene. I think she forwarded it to Eric Schoenberg. And the next thing you know, I uprooted my entire family and went to Silicon Valley. And I've been here ever since.
Thank you for that backstory. Fascinating journey and a million things we can dive into. But before we do, I want to know how we transitioned from 7-8 years of basketball to badminton. And then we'll dive in.
A couple of years ago, it's confusing with COVID. Is this pre-COVID or post-COVID? It all runs together now. Our youngest son, my wife and I, his name is Vinny, was born with autism, and he was nonverbal. And I needed to get away from coaching for a little bit. I got out of coaching. I even asked Schoenberg, I guarantee you I'm going to ask you to coach something. Say no. Let me have time with Vinny. I did that. Vinny started speaking. He's doing great now. He sings and he's athletic and all this stuff. I was able to get back into coaching. And those guys called me in the office and they're all, I know you're going to think we're crazy, but we need a badminton coach. And I told them, I can't even spell badminton. Why would I coach it? And they're all, just try it. Do everything you do. Because they knew if I just did the team culture things that I do, the kids would love it and all this. Next thing, I'm hooked. I'm fired up. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. And it's so.
And they also have great players. We had a couple of great players. And we have some returning great players. So I don't care what sport, badminton, football, golf, whatever, you're going to be a great coach when you have great players.
Yeah, no doubt. I think what I love about that, and it's my soapbox on this show, is the translation of skill set across disciplines. And I think too often, especially in what I call the youth sports industrial complex today, where they're preaching sports specialization, what ends up getting lost is the transferability of other skills that actually enhance their performance rather than taking away from it. And the fact that you made that transition reminds me of Bill Baxter, who was my AD at El Camino, who cut his teeth as a swim and water polo coach and then moved to basketball and won a state title and 3 NorCal championships. And it was like, when I talked to him about it, he's like, water polo is the same game. A fast break is just called a counterattack. And so figuring out how those things translate is part of why I do the show, part of why I want to actually share that with other people. And I would love your take on what has directly transferred as you've had to learn a new game, but coaching's coaching. So what's translated that you think back, and I do this in basketball, I do this in football.
Well, number one, your stance in basketball. We want everybody in a great stance. If you're off the ball, you need to be in the split line in a great stance. It's the same thing in badminton. You need to be ready to defend, and it starts with a great stance. And then good play, good call, bad call, go move on to the next play is really critical in badminton. Very critical in badminton. And then if you want to attack a guy's left hand because he's weak that way, it's the same thing in badminton. Most players just clear. Some don't have certain shots. We were in the state finals in badminton. And now, mind you, I have these 2 incredible players who I think have a chance, a realistic chance of being Olympic level, and they know everything. There was a timeout during the state championships, and I was telling them, like, hey, do you guys realize every time you make the other girl run on the baseline, we win the point? So we started feeding this girl running the baseline, whatever. And afterwards, they're all, coach, how'd you know that? I'm like, dude, all you got to do is watch an athlete for 2 seconds and you can tell his or her weaknesses. So a lot of this shows up. And badminton can get a little bit of an individual type of a feel in the sport, whereas I just treated it like a football, basketball, baseball team. all in, all out, team before anything else. So that was
yeah, and that again, the translation of culture and how you build a team in regards to getting the experience of doing something that is greater than yourself is what I think. I always joke that athletics is a vehicle to teach leadership, followership, and how to be part of something bigger than yourself. And it doesn't matter the discipline, it translates. Where I want to ask a follow-up in regards to when you went from helping out or wanting to be like Coach Lippi, getting to St. Liz, coaching football, and then transitioning to your first head coaching job. What is it that you realized right away that you needed to figure out? And then how did that, as you went to each new spot where you'd already done the job, but what did you realize as you got to each spot? Oh, I can't just do the same thing. I need to figure out this piece.
So it was really interesting. I get to St. Liz in July of, I don't know, 91, 92-ish. And they gave me four teaching books. I had four different preps. I was the varsity football and basketball coach. They gave me the keys and they said, good luck. There was no training, nothing like that. I made $18,000 a year. I thought I was rich. And I just remember, oh, I have all these things I'm going to do, this and that. And back then, the fly offense was popular. And I was like, no, we're going to do a 49er. I was a big Bill Walsh guy. Still am a huge Bill Walsh guy. And the next thing I know, we had, I think, 15 players show up for practice. It was an inner city school. The program was down. Suddenly, you got to understand, okay, I have one lineman that's 300 pounds, another who's 115 pounds. Maybe I can't run this offense just because I like it. So that taught me immediately to adapt. And then after the fourth year, I think we had 50-plus football players, champions, lost in the NCS finals, had one team that had four college football players on it. So that program went nuts. And yeah, sometimes as a young coach, you think you're doing something, but then you realize the situation requires you to do something else.
No doubt. And as you transitioned from St. Liz to Pinole Valley, probably got to lighten your load a little bit and be a one sport coach. What came with you and what had to shift over each of those next three or four stops?
There was a blur. Actually, I want to say in between those stops, my buddy who you know, Aaron O'Brien, he got the head coaching job at Holy Names College. So I went up there and helped him. I don't know if you can see this. Helped him. I was probably the worst assistant coach of all time. I was terrible. So, but since he's like my best friend, he understood it. And yeah.
Tell me a little bit before you go on. In hindsight, years later, because I remember when Aaron got that job, that's, 25 years ago at this point. What made you a terrible assistant? And what would you do differently now?
Gosh. First of all, Aaron and I were younger than many of the players on the team, so that was odd. I was screaming at the players, and the assistant coach should never be the heavy. Aaron was screaming too. He didn't need a heavy. I just thought, okay, we're all going to be Bobby Knight-like or whatever. So that was horrible. And thankfully it was Aaron. But when you're an assistant coach, your job is to run the head coach's system, not tell him to do it this way because of your system. I was literally terrible. And yeah, I promised myself I'll never do that again.
I love the vulnerability. That is great. All right, so coming back from St. Liz to Pinole and all of that, what stayed with you? What did you jettison over the years as you sharpened your skill set?
Well, Pinole Valley was the first time I actually began to realize you're getting a teaching credential where, wait a minute, my job is connected with my team. When there are parent problems, the way you handle it also affects your job. I was a special ed teacher, and I still kept my same coaching style, the very tough style, taught style, but I kept all of that. But it was there I realized, oh, wait a minute, your coaching actions really affect your teaching job as well. And back then, Pinole was wild. We had two lunch periods, 3,000 kids. Barely anybody actually lived in Pinole. It was North Richmond. Those were good days looking back on it. And I'm proud of the program we built there too. That was a great program.
So talk about your transition to Berkeley High School, the job you said that was your dream job. You applied three times. You finally got it. You were able to have some success. What made it your dream job? What allowed you to find success there? And why did you ultimately decide to leave?
So we got Berkeley High School, 5,000 kids. And no matter if you were at St. Liz, if you were at Pinole Valley, De Anza, competing against Berkeley, they were 15 deep with great players, right? Most high school basketball teams can be four players deep or something and have a handful of decent players. The thing about Berkeley is the 13th player is as good as the first player. So I always knew if I was there, we could make some noise. And I remember interviewing, and the AD, he said, hey, you didn't get the job, but we loved your chicken dinner fundraiser. I'm like, that's what you took away from talking to me, was you liked my chicken dinner fundraiser. I was so mad. And then I interviewed again, and Dan Pally got the job, and I loved Dan Pally and taught his daughter in school and all this. I'm like, what do I got to do to get that job? So I gave up on that. And then the job became open, went there, and it was one of those years where the administration wants to get somebody that has zero connections with the community. Sometimes the high schools get sick of the same people doing the same things over and over. And I got that job and immediately assembled a tremendous coaching staff. And I think we had, I don't know, I was just talking to Coach Roy Meisner about the tryouts. I don't know, 150 plus tried out for varsity. That's a big number. And we picked, believe it or not, 18. 18 is more than my first football team at St. Elizabeth, by the way. We had 18 on every level. That caused problems, but I wanted to have as many players say that they played high school basketball as possible. And I don't, my assistant Ed Hawkins knows all the numbers. He always spits them out or something like that. But I think we were like 74-5 in 3 years or something like that. Just an amazing run. And that was one of the best times of my life. However, I was working at Elsa Brandy Christian School, and I was the off-campus coach at Berkeley High. And so I told myself, oh man, I don't want to do that. Berkeley Unified School District pays nothing. The pay is too low. So I knew that ultimately I had to get out. And literally right after the state championship, I saw an ad for Valley Christian. And I just fired off a random email. Next thing you know, Jolene answered it and Eric Schoenberg.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that background. My follow-up on that entire situation is multifaceted. Number one, how do you manage a team when number one to 15 are the same person, right? And then you decide to take 18 purposefully to help people play sports, which is the same thing that I try to encourage here versus the arbitrary, you have to cut down to 12 in basketball. And it's like, why? If you can manage 18,
that never makes sense to me.
You can manage 18. So I would love your take on how you manage that. And then the second thing I'm going to come back to is I want to know about your transition from public to private and what that was like. And yes, you had this history of teaching at the Christian school, but going from a public high school to a private high school and everything that comes along with that, I would love your take on that initial transition and then how you learned to operate within kind of different boundaries than you were probably used to.
Incredibly different boundaries. First of all, the thing about 18 players on a basketball team is nearly impossible. So the thing I've learned, if there are any young coaches out here, whether you keep 15, 18, 13, doesn't matter. When you start to make deals with players and parents, like, hey man, it's September. I don't want to cut you. but I want you to be a great practice player. I want you to be part of the team. And the parents are there. They're like, yeah, that's when they're happy in September. Come February, they're mad that they're not playing and the parents are mad. And that generally happens. So you got to know that's going to happen. Everybody wants to play, especially when there's a lot of pub about the team and the team's winning. Everybody wants to get out there. Those are tough days trying to keep everybody happy. But we promised the team we're not going to keep everybody happy. And if you're unhappy with your role, there's the door. When you have so much talent, the players can see it. As a matter of fact, this is odd. We didn't have a player over 6'4". But it didn't matter. About the only team that could really whip on us was O'Dowd. And they had a couple great players. One's running around in the pros. Now I forget that center they had. But yeah. So anyway, you just try to manage people and manage parents, quite frankly, with the 18.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think we were talking about this in the weight room this morning with a couple of the guys that come in and lift with me about how important role definition is and repeatedly emphasizing that. And if you can do that at an elite level, you're able to reduce the number of those conflicts. And I joke all the time, and it's like the guy that's now our head coach played for me back in Sacramento. And I always tell his story. It was like he got cut as a freshman from the program, cut as a sophomore from the program. Junior year, we had a conversation that was like, hey, I love you. You keep coming back. I appreciate your work ethic. If you want a jersey, I have one for you, but you will never play. If everyone gets hurt, I'm bringing up the entire JV team before you play. Do you want to be on the team? Go talk to your parents and come back to me. Yes. Okay, great. And then, ironically enough, because the kid was a grinder and it served him well in his professional life, it's like senior year, he started for us and we won a section title. But it's like, how do you get in the weeds that clearly, follow up with them and the parents, have it in writing, and then anytime that comes up, do you remember this? Okay, cool. This is what you signed up for. And if you're now choosing not to be part of that, that's a choice. But this was our agreement. And I love that you said that early.
I think some real talk, though, has to happen, too, with the parents. And I've said it this way before. Hey, if this were a musical, everybody can't be the lead, man. Somebody's going to be that tree. If you don't want to be the tree in the background, we're going to get somebody else who wants to be the tree. We're going to get somebody else who also doesn't have a speaking part. Do you want that or not? And then are they clear on that or not? And I think the tough talk in September helps when everybody wants to play in February and March.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. All right, pivoting. Public to private. Talk about that transition. What did you realize right away that you needed to shift your perspective on? And what are some things that you found validating that you wish could transfer back to our public school brethren?
I've figured out after doing this for 100 years, this is my 34th year, my life, personal ministry and journey is with a public school kid. Okay. The realness of public school, sometimes you know that you are the only person in that kid's life. Some of them are from group homes or straight from county jail or whatever. You are making a huge impact. And then all of a sudden you go to, say, Valley Christian, where pretty much Silicon Valley, the parents have the means and everything. You can feel like I'm not really making a difference in this kid's life or whatever, but it's actually not true. It's not accurate. You're just as important. I actually came the other day and these two kids that played for me that wrote these handwritten letters. Nobody does that anymore. So that's awesome. How much I meant to them or read it or whatever. And I was like, oh my gosh. And one's at Ohio State and the other's not MIT, Caltech or something like that. You really can help all kids regardless of their financial status. I'm finding that there are situations in private schools with kids that, man, if they were at Berkeley High or Pinole Valley High, you could just get in their face and clean it up in 5 minutes. But that won't work at other places. It's just not acceptable. Sometimes it's a little harder. in the private schools. But you know what? Parents are parents. You have great parents in public school, great parents in private school. I love the parents at Valley Christian. I will say this. I coached badminton this year, and I just had a ton of fun. And on senior night, all these kids kept coming up and handing me these little envelope thank you cards. I'm like, what is this? A little gift card here. It was like 10 gift cards. I got more gift cards from the badminton kids in 1 year than I got 30 years plus at all those other dang schools. Coach badminton, if you want to feel appreciated.
I love that. Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that in that, to your point, I cut my teeth as a public school teacher and coach, and I went to public school until high school growing up. And ultimately, it's when I made the move to come back home here for me as an alum of this place, you're always wrestling with the, do they need you in the same way? And you already mentioned it. It's, look, kids are kids. They have issues and challenges that they're navigating. They're just different challenges. And so ultimately, as you show up as an adult and a mentor to help them get through those tough moments, that's what matters. That's where your impact is. And ultimately, don't discount that working in the private versus the public is some lesser version of service. It's just different.
Yes, it's just different. Yeah. And you're just as needed. Hey, I undersold how bad I was as an assistant. I have another story. 2007 or 8-ish or whatever. I was the vice principal at Pinole Valley. I wanted to move to Salesian High School. So I gave up coaching for a year. And then I started to help my buddy Bill Mellis. I'm on the state championship banner. And I'm the last name, so it looks like it was my state championship. I always loved that. And Mellis always kids that I think I made picture day as the assistant, and I'd show up on the big games. But yeah. So I just want to be really clear. I'm terrible as an assistant.
I think we've established that at this point. That's awesome. Let me circle back into the things that you're good at. So what would you say is the best thing you do in your program that is transferable? And were you to leave Valley Christian and go somewhere else and coach whatever particular sport, like, we're always doing X and here's why.
Yeah. I'm huge at making sure that all the players dress the same for practice, stand the same way. I've always believed that if you get on the kids about little things, dude, why do you have your hands on your hips? Are you a free agent? Put those hands down. If you get on the kids about the little problems, you're going to avoid the big problems. Then they won't even think about like showing up late to practice if they know they have to stand a certain way. And by the way, I'm a player's coach. I love to have fun. And I think one of the cultural things that I bring is if you played for me, I could just literally go off on you about something you've done, but then it's over. That's where I excel at. I don't care if you made a mistake. I've had people give me second, third, fourth, fifth, seventh chances in my own personal life. Why would I not give a kid all these chances? And so I think the kids know that. I know it's a cliche and all that, but we're family and I love on them. And I get really tight with the players. And that has happened wherever I've gone.
Yeah, and I would agree that's really important, right? The kids know you love them. It's going to give you a little bit more leeway. And what pops for me is, when we not go over the line, but when we coach somebody hard or when we say something, often 34 years, you don't even remember saying something to a kid that they're holding on to until this day. How would you advise I don't know what the right word is, but help people understand not just the power of you're done with it, but reconciliation in regards to, hey, you know what? That was a little extra and that's on me and I need to be better than that. How do you let them know that reconciliation exists and or have you had any moments?
Yeah, no, I get it. I think it should be on the spot. I say this a lot. I said this yesterday and I was out there coaching. Oh my God, my bad. That was terrible coaching. If they know that you are critical of yourself, then they don't mind if you're critical of them. And I'm, all of us coaches say this, you have a problem if I'm not getting on you. That means I don't care. If I'm yelling or whatever, coaching you hard, whatever description you want to use, this is an old Bobby Knight line. You might not want to listen to what I'm saying in terms of if I'm calling you any names or not. But when I start talking about why, that's when you really listen. But I don't know. I think the if you as a coach acknowledge that you screwed up this game, you screwed up this drill, they understand, oh, they get on themselves as much as they get on us. I don't know if that answered that question, but.
No, 100%. And I think that's the maturity of wisdom in time is ultimately being able to acknowledge that you are not infallible and that we make as many mistakes as the kids. And I think when you're young, it's really hard to do that. And I've always been curious for people that have had success and all of a sudden you don't have to worry about your resume anymore. It allows you to be more free with acknowledging that you're far from perfect. And it's like, how do we get the younger coaches to that level faster without necessarily having to go through the winning and losing and the mistakes and the fumbles, where the more you can be vulnerable with your athletes, the more they're actually going to follow you.
Yes. I was a young coach, naive, stupid at St. Liz. Those were back in the days when there wasn't really a game minimum or maximum rather. We were 34-4. We lost in the NorCal finals. You'd have thought we were 4-34. The players weren't happy. I wasn't happy. The parents weren't happy. And I remember after we lost, later, that was a terrible coaching job. Now, a lot of people would say, 34-4? We beat the number one team in the state? And everybody was unhappy? Yeah, that happened. I think that a lot of that was on me. But I was 25 or 6 or whatever. And so winning doesn't necessarily mean success. it was a horrible season.
Yeah, and that's hard to figure out when you're young. And I think that's a great message for people to understand is, look, everybody's metric of success is different and yours better be dialed in for what you want to impact people in your life or you're just not going to be happy. And I think that's been something where I joke all the time where I coach now and it's, I just don't care. Like, I'm going to do what I want. We're going to have a good time. We win if we lose, but I'm ultimately going to try to help people with life through sports.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. All right. Let me pivot here to something that's a little bit more personal. And it made me curious about what you've learned through that experience, but you were a special ed teacher early. And then you mentioned that Vinny was born and you realized that he had autism. And I'm curious if teaching special ed and then going through that experience as a parent, the impact that had on your ability to teach through what you were learning at home in differentiating instruction, right? It's a big buzzword, but ultimately what I'm always curious about is as I get older, I'm realizing in myself that I need to see certain things or I can't comprehend it. And if I know that now, then that means there are kids that I'm teaching that have different input preferences. So I'm curious, like, how you were able to transact on his experience, but what it did for you in terms of opening your eyes to different things.
Wow, there's a lot to that, but I'll answer this many different ways. Number one, my wife and I, we spent, I don't know, a year and a half crying every night. We thought he would never speak. They said, hey, he's nonverbal. And so it was not uncommon for her to walk in. I'd be crying in the bedroom or whatever. But then I started to remind her, like, hey, the high school students I worked with, they were fine. Vinny can get there. He can do this. And then on the days where I was down about the situation, she'd say, hey, that boy's going to speak. My wife is like a spiritual angel. She's always saying, God has this. He's going to speak. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And so I was you know, a little happy that he could get to that point that I saw those kids have when they were in high school. And all of a sudden, this dude went from not being able to speak to now he sings. Now, his favorite song is Red, Red Wine, UB40. He also, this is crazy, but if he's triggered or whatever, if I need to calm him down, I throw in Smells Like Teen Spirit, Nirvana, and it chills him out. That song makes me go crazy, but it makes him chill out. So he speaks, and today he told me to have a great day, and I love you and all this. So you just have to battle, and I think that each day with autism is like coaching one day at a time. What Vinny taught me I was doing wrong, and once I got to be a real seasoned coach, you celebrate small successes with Vinny, and he's almost waiting for you to celebrate it. But sometimes as an older coach, Bill Mellis, we all stole this offense. He calls it fist or whatever. It's really just an old Kansas offense. After you see your teams do it for 15 years successfully, and then all of a sudden you're at, say, Berkeley or Valley Christian, and they run fist for the first time, they do it great. You're like, okay, good. No, man, that's the first time they've done this. It might be the thousandth time you've seen it, but you need to make sure that you celebrate that and take that small success. And that's how they can build on it, how Vinny can build on it with learning to read. Something really different about autism is Vinny was the first kid to read, first kid to write. There's some great things about it. I think, though, that Vinny personally has made me a better parent and definitely a better coach.
No, I appreciate you sharing that. That is super helpful from a contextual standpoint to understand what you just shared. The small victories are meaningful, and we often forget those. And how do you celebrate those on a daily basis as humans, as coaches, as every role you play?
There's something else that kind of helped me become a better coach. I know this is going to sound random. I look athletic and all this except my belly. I'm like really fat. And so I got into Bikram yoga, right? The hot yoga. And I'm in there, and I'm telling you, I wanted the instructor. Like, the instructors generally are these incredible gals that are awesome at it. And I was catching them saying, oh, great pose, Cindy. Great pose, Samantha. And I'm like, one day she's going to say great pose. I want her to say great pose, coach. And so that taught me, like, oh, wait a minute. You know what? Just a little pick me up to every basketball player. Every practice can go a long way. I had to learn that by trying to lose weight.
Yes. However, I think what we often, I'm not going to say dismiss because it's not the right word, but we're not aware of until we're in that moment. How instruction lands, how feedback lands. As I said, I'm a person that like needs to see something. And I was doing some Pilates at one point, and the instructor would tell me do X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. You have to put me in the position. And so like the way in which we all learn and process feedback only came by me failing at other things as an adult that then right. I can transfer over. So I love that analogy. And it's going to take me to my last question, which is, what have you most recently changed your mind on? And doesn't have to do anything with sports, coaching, parenting, whatever. But the idea that growth mindset is real. It's only going to help you grow. If you're not challenging your assumptions and your beliefs, then you're hurting yourself. And so I always ask this, hey, I used to be over here and now I'm over here. And here's why, where it was an intentional decision you made to change your way of thinking.
Oh man, I don't know how real you want me to be or not, but the only way I know is to be very real. Early in my coaching career, I had all kinds of success in terms of wins and losses and championships and section championships and this and that. I was always that guy. We're going to practice twice on Thanksgiving. I don't care about your families wanting to be together. We're going on Christmas Eve. We're going to have open gym on Christmas. Just stupid. and not really having the right priorities. It cost me a family. Now I get it. I understand. Hey, man, you can be just as good and allow, people to have Thanksgiving Day and Christmas and all that stuff. Thankfully, in high school, they didn't allow us to coach on Sundays, or I'd have been that guy that coached on Sundays too. I just thought you constantly have to be at practice and constantly have to be working. And it was too much for my players and too much for me. And it cost me a lot. But I now understand. There was an old coach at Hayward High School. His name was Charlie something or rather 100 years ago. And I remember he was making fun of Aaron O'Brien and I. Oh, where'd you guys go? 3 hours today? And we went an hour and a half. And we're like, yeah, we thought he was kidding. He wasn't kidding. And not only were Aaron my team going 3 hours, I would go 3 hours and he would be helping me coach. Then we'd go to San Leandro and go 3 hours and I'd help him coach. That's basically 8 hours. This is also on top of having a job. Where's your family time? Where's time for your players to just maybe relax and get away from it? I didn't understand diminished returns. And now I do.
I appreciate that story more than because it's where I am at now. I joke, I'm a seasonal coach. We start November 1 and we finish when the season's over. And it's, you're not playing this summer. You're not doing this. No, like we're fine. It's all good. I want my kids playing other sports. I want them having a full experience. And if it costs us 2 wins, great, we'll survive. And I think it's a great point of view at this point in your career as a grizzled vet to help the youngsters understand, hey, you're going to be in the same place. It's what that old coach was trying to tell you guys way back when. And I love that. So thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Hey, I want to tell you another quick one. It was probably Aaron and I and Melis or whatever. We were also those guys that wanted to play 70 to 75 games in the summer. And remember Tom Blackwood at Miramani? He coached for 40 years or whatever. And we were complaining about the parents or something being bad or whatever. And he goes, do you realize this is all your fault? And we're like, us? He's like, yeah. Before you guys showed up, we would have basketball season. It would be basically the end of October to February. That was the only time we saw the players and parents. Just by the time they started to hate you at the end of the season was over. But now because of you guys, we all got to keep doing this summer stuff and we're all around each other. It's too much. And same lesson. Sometimes you can go overboard with all of it.
Agreed. And that's a great place to stop because that is what I wish the entire youth sports industrial complex would hear and give these kids part of their life back and allow them to be versatile and multifaceted. But we can't control those, only our own school site. So I appreciate you being here today, Coach. Thanks for jumping on.
Yeah, thank you. Peace.
This podcast was also brought to you by ttroops.com. As coaches, our inboxes will get flooded with noise on how to make your program better. TeachHoops.com will get you focused on what needs to get done. One thing you've heard from these podcasts is no matter the experience, you gotta keep pushing yourself to be better. Coach Steve Collins will help you direct that noise. He is there to help you. He has the credentials as a coach, and he's never turned down an Teach Hoops member. Sign up for a plan at TeachHoops.com and mention us at checkout. This site is here simply to help you be better. Take advantage and see you on the court. Remember, go to teachhoops.com.
This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With 8 delicious flavors, you're guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice and games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another electrolyte product. Without amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first Element order, Element will give us 100% commission. Last thing, Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you'll be instantly refunded.